cause, and I'm sure good. But as a result, we get at least 10 more minutes of Steve and question period afterwards, and Russell Redenbaugh is going to come up, and we're going to have a good time this morning. Steve Forbes. Thank you very much, George, for those very kind words. You said the word summit brought back fantasies. You know, slide one, you have a summit conference. And, you know, amazing what words can bring back in terms of association. But it is good fun to be here. And I've been asked this morning again to give an overview of where we are economically, what are the opportunities and the challenges. And we're in one of these peculiar periods right now where the global economy, you'd never know it from what the media says, the global economy today has rarely had the overall kind of growth rates that we've experienced in the last couple of years. One would have to go back to the 50s and 60s to find those kind of global growth rates. Yet you read the media and everything is gloom and doom. So what I'd like to do is just quickly do a global view, country by country, and then talk about the challenges and why people, I think, are kind of down right now, uncertain. Part of it is human nature. We go through some of these funk periods. A good example was the early 1990s. We did for our 75th anniversary. In 1992, we did a cover story, Why Do We Feel So Bad When Things Are Going So Well? We had essays. And lo and behold, the 90s turned out to be a fantastic decade for growth and innovation, reforms around the world. But at the beginning of the decade, it wasn't until the mid-90s that people really realized the economy here in the United States was growing for real. Up until then, it was full of uncertainties. People were wondering whether the thing was going to falter, go off a cliff again. So we go through these funk periods. Part of it's normally human nature. But unfortunately right now, there are some good reasons to be in a bit of a funk, things to really worry about, and I want to touch on those, but first let me give you a quick review of the global economy. Here at home, the American economy, since the tax cuts of 2003, has been growing at a 3.5%, 4% growth rate. There's no reason why, if you look at the fundamentals, if we don't make some egregious policy errors, and I'll talk about some of the dumb things we can do and are doing, there's no reason why. You should have elected me, and then, you know. We could have been doing this at the White House, you know, really. But anyway, enough of that. But if there's no reason why this expansion, which really kicked in May of 2003, couldn't be as long-lived and as durable as both of the expansions of the 80s and 90s. Productivity boom is real. You represent it. Companies are learning more and more to use these innovations, make themselves more productive, and you may even get revolutionary things. For example, when you go to airports now, the only thing that makes our air system prevented from being totally and utterly dysfunctional are kiosks. You know, you can either go online and get your ticket or get to the airport, go to those kiosks, punch in your card, and boom, you got your ticket. Some of you may be old enough to remember it wasn't that many years ago when you go to the airport and you knew you'd have to stand in line, you'd always pick the slowest line to get your bloody ticket, and it was just bad from the get-go. Well, sadly, with the arrival of the kiosks, also sadly came 9/11, so even though you don't stand in ticket lines now, you stand with those friendly people from the transportation department. But those kiosks, are really a fantastic innovation, and people are starting to use them in very interesting ways. For example, a group of McDonald's franchisees in Florida, they didn't get permission from Illinois to do this, they just did it on their own, contracted with a company to build kiosks for their restaurant. And the thing has been revolutionary. You go into these McDonald's, punch in what you want instead of standing in line at the counter, so you punch it in, go up to the counter and pick up your food. And these franchisors thought, gee, this way we can cut down on labor costs because you won't need as many people to take the orders. People do it themselves, get better productivity, better profitability. Well, as often happens with productivity, it is a job. job creator. First of all, you have higher per person orders when you do it with a kiosk instead of a live person. And they've done a number of tests on this, and it's absolutely true. The average per person order is about a buck or two higher. Why? Because when you go to the kiosk, you're not facing a human being, so if you order four supersized milkshakes, there's no one there to give you, no pimply teenager to give you that look for, you are a big old fat slob and here you go, going to make it worse. No censorship with the kiosk. It is absolutely neutral. So people feel free to order more. It's in a discreet bag when you go up to the counter, scoop it off, and on your way to go and do your food sinning. But the other thing they found out was that because people ordered more food, they had to hire more people, not to man the counters, but to produce more food in the kitchen. Amazing. And another thing that's happened, and again, I haven't read the section in USA Today, but they have a special section on how hotels now are getting fancier and fancier. There's a big boom in the lodging industry. But one of the things they really haven't done yet are kiosks. A couple of hotels are trying them. I tried one the other day. Hyatt had one. You go up to the kiosk in the lobby, stick in your card, punch in your number, and you get your key, and you're off to your room in a matter of seconds. The biggest aggravation of any place, resort, hotel, motel, no matter what it is standing in bloody line to get your room, and you hope you're in the super-duper mileage pointage, whatever it is, so you can get cut out the peasant standing in the other line. But it's just like the airport used to be, just this utter aggravation. But again, if they ever get on these things, and eventually they will, competition will bring it about, one of the biggest aggravations of travel goes away. You go to the hotel, boom, 30 seconds, you're off to your room. If you want to upgrade, they can tell you to upgrade. If you want to change your room, you can. Boom, 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 done. No human interface. So you can't get snarly at somebody, so you don't feel bad that you lost your temper. Everyone's happier all around. Happier clerks, happier you, happier. So productivity is for real. And again, the precursors of all this are ATMs. When ATMs came in years ago, starting in the mid-1970s, the dream of the banking industry was they wouldn't have to have hotel tellers anymore. I mean, the bank tellers anymore. Well, guess what happened? Today, there are more bank tellers than ever before. Now, when ATMs came in, there were about 470,000. Now, there are about 520,000. Why? Even though most people do their banking through an ATM now, any hour of the day, if you have special needs, you can go into the bank teller. And so the banks are offering more services. Contrary to what everyone thought, more banks are popping up, more offices are popping up, even though ATMs are ubiquitous. So productivity is a job creator, and the productivity boom is for real, and it's just beginning as we learn to apply these things in more and more ways. In terms of personal incomes in America, again, contrary to what the media would have you believe, personal incomes are going up in America. Another thing that's happening is that companies, especially small and medium-sized companies, are starting to spend a little more on capital spending. Big companies are still in their cash mode, but that'll change. And so you have that juice there. You also have inventories for most industries are still fairly low, still fairly tight, so there's plenty of growth potential there. And the other thing that's happening is liquidity. America has never been or rarely been as liquid as it is today. On the corporate side, if you take what companies have in cash or cash equivalents, subtract out what they owe in short-term debt, corporate America today is almost plus $2 trillion. Rarely in the economic history has cash been such a large part of corporate assets. Companies are awash in cash. Even though there are many of them are still in the clutch the mode, even though CFOs are still acting like CEOs, the cash is there overall. But the unheralded story is how liquid the American consumer is. Again, myth has it that we are a nation of wastrels, a nation of spendthrifts, living from credit card to credit card, hoping we can get a new credit card with a new credit limit so we can keep the thing going. Our houses are up to hock to a fare-thee-well, and then we're on a precipice of a disaster. Well, again, if you look at reality, take what people own in bonds, individual households, not corporate, individuals, what people own in bonds, stocks, mutual funds, 401ks, life insurance policies, money market funds, CDs, and the like. Take what people have in liquid assets, paper assets, and people owe on their credit cards, what they owe on their mortgages. Put aside the value of your house. Just take the mortgage as straight debt. You take what people have in paper assets, subtract out what people have in debt, including mortgages. American households today are plus almost $26 trillion. You'd never know it, but American households today are the biggest supplier of credit to the global financial market. Utterly contrary to myth. Now, why do we think we're a nation of wastrels? Again, part of it's human nature. Incomes, personal incomes, are never enough. No matter how much your income goes up, somehow your unmet needs quickly catches up to it. For one day your income goes up, you feel great, then suddenly you have unmet needs, and boom, you feel it's tight again. So you don't feel very good about it. You always feel you're under the gun. Again, it's human nature. But part of it, too, is that our reporters, too many of our analysts, don't look at the balance sheet. You know, you've got liabilities, but you also have assets. And the assets, especially liquid assets, are unheralded phenomenon. You may buy a stock, but you don't think of that stock, those shares, as money in the bank, but it is an asset. If you have to sell it, you can sell the thing. So liquid assets, we're up to almost $26 trillion. So the juice is there for a long-term expansion. Then you look around the world. You look at China. China's still growing. Now, China's coming to a proverbial crossroads. Why? Because they have had a large part of their growth has come from an export-oriented policy, importing foreign capital, going for exports. For a country of that size, that's a pretty dumb economic policy long-term. They should look at the model of the United States in the 19th century, where our growth came from internal growth. Sure, we absorbed a lot of foreign capital, especially from the Scottish Trust and the English and the Dutch, but a lot of the capital is created here at home. We expanded internally. Trade was a part of our economy, but most of the growth came internally. That should be the model for China. Now, can they do it? Can the local satraps of the Communist Party leave entrepreneurs alone long enough so that they can really get this entrepreneurial revolution really going in the countryside? Very much of an open question. Like anything, when you grow, growth presents new problems, new opportunities, but also new challenges. Another thing China has to do, and our friend Hernando de Soto, I don't know if you've heard him in the past, but he's a phenomenal economist from Peru, and he asked the question years ago. He said, there's no lack of energy and entrepreneurship around the world. You go to countries like Brazil, Peru, Bangladesh, you find on the streets plenty of people hawking their wares, plenty of people making things, trying to sell things. So it's not a lack of energy, not a lack of work ethic. Why aren't these countries growing the way they are in the West? We found out, discovered first, it's almost impossible in most of these countries to set up a legal business. We take it for granted in this country. You set up a business, you can do it in a matter of days, and it doesn't mean you're going to succeed, but it's a fairly routine thing to set up a legal entity. In most countries, it's almost an impossibility. It takes months going through various bureaucracies, paying off God knows how many, contributing to how many deprived civil servants. So to set up a legal business. No surprise, most businesses, most countries, are illegal, informal. It's the only way people can get things done. But that puts a natural cap on how much a company can grow, an entity can grow. You dare not hire, go beyond your family or friends. You can barely get your national economy, much less the global economy. It's an artificial restraint. It stunts the growth of these countries because they don't have the institutions that allow this entrepreneurship, this energy to grow. It all boils down to probably the most boring subject around, which is property rights. As I told you in the past, if you ever find yourself traveling in coach in the middle seat, and you want to clear the both seats, don't talk about your health, although that'll help drive people nuts and want to get away from you. But talk about property rights. If anything, they'll fall right asleep right in the aisle, and you'll have your elbow room. But again, Hernando asked a very simple question. Why was it 100 years ago that hundreds of thousands of people in the early part of the 20th century emigrated from Japan to countries like Peru and Brazil? Why? Because in those days, countries like Peru, Brazil, Argentina had 2 to 3 times the per capita GDP as did Japan. What in the world happened in the meantime? Why isn't Peru sort of the Hong Kong, Switzerland of today? Why is Brazil? Why is the phrase in Brazil, even though they're starting to grow again, they should be a colossus today economically, and the phrase there in Brazil, the Brazilians will tell you this, Brazil has a great future and always will. Why hasn't it really taken off? Why does it get to growth and then fall back? Industries develop, but why can't Brazil be the China and India? What is going on there? Argentina, once one of the top eight economies in the world, now ranking, what, 60th, 70th, 80th, depending on the numbers and exchange rates. What went wrong? What went wrong, one of the things that went wrong was property rights. Most people don't have basic property rights. We take it for granted. You buy a condominium here, you can go to a bank in Toronto, you can go to a bank in Florida, you can go to a bank in Vermont and get financing for it. Everyone knows that you own the thing. It's a uniform property system. Very complicated. When you buy it, you have to sign 800 sheets of paper. But it all goes back to English common law. Everyone knows that you own that piece of property. In most countries, only about 20% of the population is part of what you might call a Western-style property rights system. China last year, by one account, had 74,000 revolts, uprisings, riots. People feeling they're not part of this growth thing, protesting the oppression of local communist satraps, kleptocrats, and the like. So when you go to the coastal cities, you go to Shanghai, you feel, boy, I'm in the West. Boy, boom, boom, boom. You go in other parts of China, he's lagging. What is going on? You see it in Latin America. You see your friends from Latin America, you think, boy, you're part of the global economy. You go to the shanty towns, they're not part of the global economy. They don't have that uniform property system. So 80% of the people are out of it. Now, Japan had a feudalistic property system. A handful of people owned the land. And after World War II, MacArthur put in a new system. His people put in a new system. What they did was take a survey around Japan and find out what the real system was. You had the nominal owners were the lords and the feudal landowners. But below that, the peasants had an elaborate system of trading land with each other. It was sort of winked at. They didn't formally own the land, but they got to use it. But it wasn't recognized. It was, in effect, dead capital. So, in effect, long story short, after the war, we put in a Western-style property system, just took what the Japanese peasants in those days were doing informally and made it formal. That was the property reform. And so made the system formal. Suddenly, the whole population was in the property system. That was a critical, unheralded reason why Japan had the mammoth growth rates of the 50s and 60s. Nations, most people are without addresses. Most of it is informal. Crazy, isn't it? So instead of throwing foreign aid at countries in Africa, instead of telling the Chinese, you know, revalue or devalue your currency, depending on the flavor of the day, urge them to develop basic property rights system. When people have a stake in it, suddenly you have institutions develop, grow up for sustained long-term growth, so that China does not go the way of Argentina, Peru, and much of the Brazilian economy. Remember, 20% are in it, 80% out. How do you bring the other 80% in? Very, very big unanswered question. But nonetheless, at the moment, China's growing. India's growing. They have the same challenges there. Bring in more people into a more Western-style property system. But they are experiencing very rapid growth rates. The Pacific Rim, some of those countries are moving ahead. When Korea gets a new president, maybe they'll get a good growth path again. But overall, Pacific Rim not in bad shape. Then you look at Europe, old Europe. What's going to save Europe, and the reason why there's a bit of optimism you can look at there despite the craziness of the recent German election, is the 10 new members of the European Union. They joined it in May of 2004. Those 10 new members, most of them are small countries except for Poland. But their model, those countries, their model is not Germany or France. Their model is Ireland. As you know, generation and a half ago, Ireland was the poorest economy, weakest economy in Western Europe. The joke was their biggest export was people. About a generation and a half ago, they said enough is enough. Put in, they always had a welcome mat out for foreign investment, but they really ramped up the welcome mat, slashed their corporate tax rates, gave away tax holidays like confetti, and lo and behold, slashed their personal income tax rates. Today, the corporate tax rate in Ireland is now 12.5%. It would be lower, but the EU got on their backs about it. In a generation, Ireland went from the weakest economy to the most dynamic economy in Western Europe. You know, we prattle here about housing bubbles. You go to the west coast of Ireland, which I did a year ago on a bike trip, property housing there has gone up eightfold in the last 15 years. The place is exploding. Ireland today's per capita income, for those of you who know the troubled history between Ireland and Britain, best revenge is success. Ireland's per capita income today is higher than that of Britain, higher than that of France, higher than that of Germany. They did it in a generation. Central and Eastern European countries are looking at that and saying, by golly, this is the way we got to go. But guess what? Most of them have put in the flat tax. Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia. Ten of them have done it. And contrary to the worries here that if you put it in, the politicians will raise it, in Estonia, they're cutting it. They put in originally a very high rate of 27%. Now they're bringing it down to 20%. The prime minister there said, once you go to the flat tax, you never want to go back to what you had before. The thing is simple. It works. Even Russia, not a bastion of Jeffersonian democracy. Even Russia got it right on the tax side. Their code made ours look simple. In Russia, 4 years ago, they put in the flat tax. And in 4 years, their income, their government revenues, in real terms from the income tax has gone up fourfold. I mean, twice. Fourfold nominally, but in real terms, more than twice, over 100% in just 4 years, their government revenues have grown. So it works. And what has already happened is forced countries like Austria. Austria slashed their corporate tax rate. Why? Because Slovakia put in a flat tax. Other countries are cutting their corporate tax rate. They felt to survive, they had to do the same thing. Well, guess what? They started sucking companies, sucking sound, from Bavaria, southern Germany. So even Schroeder, no supply sider, made noises before the last campaign about cutting corporate tax rates just to stay competitive with what the Austrians were doing. So this thing is having a domino effect. And in the German election, if Ms. Merkel had ever advocated real tax reform, she said she was going to appoint a finance minister who was a big advocate of the flat tax. Then when the other side started to attack it, she didn't defend it. It was an incoherent, utterly incoherent campaign, none of the Reagan-esque sunshine of the future, and blew it big time. But eventually, I think even the Germans will get it right, simply because their neighbors are going to be doing it, and when Germany goes, by golly, Europe is going to come back to life again. If you look around the world, you can see there are very real possibilities of growth. So what are the challenges? What are the things that are standing in the way? What is the reason why we're so funked out today? Gloom and doom about the future. Well, here we get to China again. One of the big things, one of the big uncertainties out there is trade. Right now, in one of these periods of protectionism, one of these periods where the intellectual bankruptcy of much of the economics profession or what people learn about economics, which isn't much, really hits home. And that is trade. I think I've told some of you before, if I was dictator of the world, I would ban trade numbers. It's just a source of mischief. Nobody knows what, say, Oregon's trade deficit is with New Mexico. Nobody cares. What you want to know is, how are you doing? Now, right now, we have a big trade deficit, merchandise trade deficit. It ignores the capital side, which becomes more and more important in the global economy, thanks to high tech, very easy to move capital around. Ignores all capital flows, just focuses on merchandise. We have a trade deficit. Unfortunately, most politicos and most of the media and too many economists who should know better equate that with a company losing money, that your cash flow is red, you're losing money, and the day of reckoning is going to come. Well, it's nonsense. Most of that trade results from commercial transactions, where both parties think they're getting something out of it. It's a meaningless number. Just remember, in North America, North America's had a trade deficit for 350 out of the last 400 years, going back to Jamestown, settlement in Jamestown. North America's had a chronic trade deficit. The only time we had a trade, merchandise trade surplus in the United States was from the First World War to the early 1970s. The rest of the time, we were in the red. And just look around you at the utter disaster this 350 years of trade deficit. woe is us. What a catastrophe. It is a meaningless number. For example, we at Forbes have a perpetual trade deficit with our paper companies. They always have a trade surplus against us and have had since 1917 when we went into business. One of the companies is a Finnish company, so we contribute to this downfall of America. We buy some paper from Finland. We always have a perpetual trade deficit on the paper front. But so what? I mean, presumably we buy the paper because we're going to provide value added, turn it into a product that people will pay up for, advertise in, make money, do conferences like this. So what's the problem? Company makes a profit, but we make a profit too because we're buying that, even though we have a trade deficit with that company or those companies, those paper companies. It's all part of a commercial transaction, value added. iPod buys their parts overseas. But the value add is in the design, the technology. So they make money here. Retailers make money here. Apple shareholders are up tens of billions of dollars in equity value because of that thing that everyone now feels they can't live without but never heard of 5 years ago. But it contributes to the trade deficit. Now, I have a book out. You can tell how well it's doing, the fact it's in your bag with no bill in it. But... not like Book of the Month, negative option, but you know, that, I don't know where the thing was physically printed, but let's, for illustrative sake, say it was printed in Thailand. On paper, my God, disaster. Printed a book in Thailand, $2 trade deficit with Thailand. Woe is us, the world's coming to an end. Book comes back here, and guess what happens? Publisher gets a cut, author gets a wee cut, truckers get a cut, Amazon gets a cut, retailers get a cut, soon the remainder stores will get a cut, the recyclers will get a cut. All the value added is here. But if you just look at trade numbers, you'd think, oh my God, $2 red. Trade has nothing to do with profitability. It's all about commercial transactions. If the transaction makes sense to you or Walmart or us when we buy paper, hey, that's what capitalism, democratic capitalism is about. You buy inputs, you hope to do outputs, where you get value added, and we move ahead. Both sides benefit from the transaction. But instead, we're told that it's a disaster. We have a big trade deficit with China, which means they're hoarding all these treasury bills. They're going to turn them into super atomic missiles and wipe us off the face of the earth. But, you know, this stuff has repercussions. So as a result of the trade deficit, we are now putting relentless pressure on the Chinese to revalue their currency. The Chinese, 11 years ago, tied the RMB to the U.S. dollar. Smart thing to do. Currency should not fluctuate in value. They should be stable value. That's the heresy with most economists today. They think you can somehow get a shortcut to growth by changing the value of your currency. Let me tell you, everything, any change you make that helps one industry hurts another industry. It should be fixed in terms of real value. For example, I told you before, Fox watches have 60 minutes in an hour. Imagine if we floated the watch, the clock. One day, 60 minutes in an hour. Next day, 30 minutes. The next day, 90 minutes. Suddenly, you have to buy derivatives, futures, hedging on figuring out how many hours you're really getting work each day. Or imagine building a facility here. Let's say we floated the ruler. 12 inches in a foot one day, 10 inches the next, 18 inches the next. Makes things hard to do. The same thing happens, very disruptive, very confusing. Same thing happens when you have changed values of currency. It all boils down in terms of currency. Nothing to do with trade flows. Or the Asian crisis in 97, these countries, many of them had trade surpluses. They did not have budget deficits. If you print too much money, you have a problem. If you print too little money, you have a problem. But in terms of currency, stability is good. It allows you to focus on real things, not trying to cover yourself because of that uncertainty. However, we're putting pressure on the Chinese. They announced a few months ago a small evaluation. Right now, because of storms, because of Iraq, we're not focusing on China, but I guarantee you in the next few months, in the next year or two, we're going to be bashing Beijing again, saying you've got to revalue because there's a disaster at hand. We did it with Japan 30 years ago. Japan had a big trade surplus. Today, the dollar is worth about 25-30% on the yen what it was 30 years ago. And guess what? We still have a big trade deficit with Japan. Put in simple terms, say two 740 BMWs, I'm just making up numbers, can buy you seven Hyundai Sonatas. Now, if you change the value of the currencies, you may suddenly find those two BMWs only buy you five Sonatas. You can eventually wake up and say, I'm getting shafted, and prices are going to readjust again. You can't manipulate currencies for long. It's just very disruptive. You buy something, you can be fooled short-term because of a sudden change in currency value, but eventually people catch up to the fact they're either getting a windfall gain or a windfall loss, and things start to adjust, but it's a very messy adjustment. But right now, putting huge pressure on China. And on the trade front, CAFTA, Central American Free Trade Agreement, six Central American countries, good deal for us. Passed the House by what, one vote? Barely made it. The Doha round, in trouble. They're going to have a ministerial meeting in December. They'll paper over the fact they've made very little progress. But trade is in big trouble, and we are not giving the leadership we need on it. Trade is like a bicycle, proverbial cliche, but true. You're not moving, you're going to fall over. You can't stop. You've got to continue to liberalize trade, or else protectionist forces get the ascendancy. So that is a real downer. Now, there are a few downers here at home. George has spoken about our disaster on broadband. The administration has given up any spending restraints. I hate it when they compare it to drunken sailors. At least sailors defend the country. These guys just spend and waste our money. You see it in the way they blew Social Security. It was a real positive reform. I give them credit for taking up the cudgels on that. But they made a big mistake. They never put out a specific reform proposal, comprehensive proposal. They figured if they did, they'd get attacked for it. But guess what happened? When they put the issue on the table, they got attacked anyway. Because they didn't have a specific proposal on the table, guess what happened? Guess what happened? Everyone figured the worst. Grandma's going to get thrown in the ditch. Taxes are going to go roaring up. Benefits are going to be slashed for one and all. So they lost it. If they put a specific reform proposal on the table, people would quickly realize if you're above the age of 50 or 55, you're out of this. The money is there for you. This is really about what do we do about people in their 20s and 30s. If that's the debate, suddenly a lot of the steam goes out of it. The elderly, they're not affected. They're taken care of so they can focus on, okay, what do I do about my grandkids on this thing? They're not affected. People in their 20s and 30s realize they are affected. They're getting shafted. So what do we do about it? Suddenly you have an atmosphere where you can get positive reforms going. But there are two, so they blew it on Social Security. They're blowing it on spending. New Orleans, they're throwing a lot of money there. I just hope they go ahead with these enterprise zones, serious enterprise zones, where they eliminate taxes. Hey, if it works in the Gulf, it can work in the rest of the country. So I will forgive them for wasting money there if they put in enterprise zones that can spread to the rest of the country. Very big if. We'll see if they have the backbone to push those tax-free, true school choice zones through where entrepreneurs and parents that care about their kids can have a real freedom to exercise true choice. You'd see that region come back very, very rapidly. We'll see if they do it. But there are two big uncertainties weighing on the stock market today. Here we are, profits keep coming in above expectations. Why is it? Why is it the market is in the doldrums? I think there are two big uncertainties. One is the tax side. As you know, there's a good tax bill passed in 2003. I'll repeat it to you again, not because you don't know it, but because I want you to repeat it to your friends and acquaintances. Taxes are not just a means of raising revenue. Taxes are also a price and a burden. The tax you pay on income is the price you pay for working. Tax you pay on profits, the price you pay for being successful. Tax on capital gains, the price you pay for taking risks that work out. The idea is very simple. When you lower the price and burden of good things like productive work, success, risk-taking, you get more of them. 2003, lowered cap gains from 20 to 15, personal dividends from 38 to 15, lowered some personal tax rates, had a few incentives in for investment for business. They put timetables on those things. First, Washington doesn't know how to calculate the impact of taxes. CBO, Congressional Budget Office, OMB, Office of Management and Budget, their calculations, they had to do, if they were in the private sector making predictions like that, they'd go broke. No, I wouldn't say that. They'd be heralded as gurus, and you'd see them on CNN. But, you know, being wrong doesn't seem to have anything to do with your being a talking head on TV. But anyway, their record is miserable. If they're a mutual fund, they'd be in the bottom. They'd get a grade F. With their predictive capabilities. They're always wrong. In this past fiscal year, which ends at the end of the month, they underestimated revenues by $100 billion. Never in history has government revenues in real terms, except in wartime, grown as much in the past 12 months as we have in this fiscal year about to close out. Because the economy starts to move, Washington gets its cut, states get their cut. And yet, these tax cuts, even though they grossly underestimated the impact these tax cuts would have, because they felt the tax cuts always cost the government money, they put in expiration dates. Starting in 2008, these tax cuts expire unless they're renewed, which is so right now in post-storm environment, the mantra is these tax cuts help the rich, therefore they ought to be repealed or allowed to expire. The administration may be ready to drop the reform on taxes, drop the ball on reform even before they picked it up. They have a tax advisory panel headed by two ex-senators, a Democrat and a Republican. They're supposed to have made a report in July. Because of Social Security, they put it off to the end of September. Now, because of the storm, who knows when they're going to make a report. They may do it on Thanksgiving weekend when no one pays attention to it or something like that. But instead of seeing taxes as a way of getting back the initiative, they may drop it. So these good tax cuts that made possible the growth of the economy since May of 2003 may expire. That's an uncertainty. The other big uncertainty is our friends at the Federal Reserve. Alan Greenspan has only been on the job for 18 years. He still hasn't learned it yet, Central Banking 101. I'll be blunt. The Fed is raising short-term interest rates, but they're also printing too much money. You can see it in commodity prices. The best barometer is the gold price. I told you in the past, if gold goes below $300 an ounce, it's like a car, SUV, truck, whatever it is you drive. You don't put in sufficient fuel, even though you have a magnificent machine, you don't put in sufficient fuel, guess what happens? Stall. You put in too much fuel, you flood the engine. We're flooding the engine now. The Fed is doing a milder version of what it did in the 70s. Interest rates going up, nominal cost of money going up, but still printing too much money. Gold's now breached $400 an ounce, now breached $450 an ounce. That's a red light flashing. Inflation, mild inflation will continue unless they soak up some of that excess money they created. It's very easy to do. They just sell bonds from their portfolio, absorb the cash, problem solved. They haven't done it yet. Look at the price of gold. If it went below $450, $400 an ounce, so say at $380, $390, great. You'd see this market go off like a rocket. But instead, they're mucking up monetary policy, making a hash of it. Very, very dangerous thing to do. This gets to oil. Contrary to what the media tells you, the real bubble is not in housing. The real bubble is in the price of oil. It has gone beyond inflation, beyond supply and demand. Most hedge funds are speculating to a fairly well. It's been a very profitable thing where other investments have not been. About $20 a barrel is pure speculation. Eventually, reality will set in. Now, the Chinese are blamed for this. I had a cold last week. Should have blamed it on the Chinese, you know. Or Bush's global warning, one or the other. But anyway, in terms of what the Fed is doing, it is creating too much money. And as long as it does that, you're going to see that uncertainty remain. That uncertainty will remain. So, taxes uncertainty, Federal Reserve uncertainty, two things that are holding the market back. Now, let me say something else about taxes. Tell from the book where my mind is right now. There's no way in this competitive world we can reform the federal income tax code. We tried that in 1986. Simplified it a little bit, threw out some tax shelters, reduced the number of brackets down to 2, 28, and 15%. But they left the beast alive. Then the code was 6 million words. They left it alive. Since then, hardly had the signature dried in Reagan's signature, the ink dried in Reagan's signature in 86. Washington went back to its old ways, but the beast was allowed to live. Since then, the code has been amended 14,000 times. 3 million words have been added to the thing. 3 million words. Today, there's 9 million words and rising. And it's not just the rates are too high. It's not just you don't have to go to the Amazon to find exotic creatures. You can find them in the tax code. It is a corrupter of life. Everything we do now in Washington, half the lobbying revolves around the tax code. Contributions are made for access. The tax bill last year, every year they pass a tax bill, and the subtitle remains the same. Leave no lobbyist behind, act. Leave no tax lawyer unemployed, act. Just to show how bad this is, even one of my favorite companies, Starbucks, got caught up in this. A company that prides itself on its ethics. One of the most amazing companies around. I mean, they showed there's no such thing as a mature industry. Coffee consumption in America peaked in 1962 per capita. There's no bigger commodity out there than coffee. But they created an aura around it. They took a shot of espresso, threw in steamed milk, and called it latte. And we line up, spending $3, $4, $5 on the thing. We don't mind buying their 10,000-calorie pastries. And they've shown something about self-esteem. I mean, when you go in there, it's not small, medium, large. Small now becomes large. Medium. Medium sounds like mediocre. They change it to grande. You're not medium, you're grande. And large now becomes vente. I mean, I wonder where the fashion industry is. You know, instead of having shirts with X, with L with six X's beside them, which hurts your self-esteem, or if you're a woman, instead of worrying about size 26, imagine going to the store, instead of a large section, you have beauté vente. So Starbucks is on something. But even last year, they slipped in this tax bill. There was a credit for manufacturers. They slipped in a provision, 300-word footnote I reprinted in my book, middle of the night, that defines manufacturing. One of the definitions of manufacturing is crushing coffee beans. They now get this tax credit. Now, imagine if you, in the morning, crush coffee beans, and try to take a tax deduction for it. If you did that, you'd be calling up Martha to find out what color your ankle bracelet should be. You couldn't do it. But this thing goes on all the time. It's a corrupter. You have old socks. Maybe give them away and get a tax deduction instead of throwing them out. You come to a conference like this, hey, you may sneak off to the golf course, find a vacation, get a tax deduction. I mean, it just corrupts, corrodes everything we do. Bonus, you take it in December or January, tax reasons. May sell something for tax reasons. May give away assets to your kids before you want to for tax reasons. Everything we do is affected by the tax code. So there's only one thing to do with this beast, this monster. That is kill it, drive a stake through its heart, bury it, and hope it never rises again. It's the only thing to be done with it. I'd replace it with a flat tax. Replace it with a flat tax. Long story short, on the personal side, you have generous exemptions for adults and for children, family of four, mom, dad, two kids, $46,000 free of income tax. Above that, only 17% rate. No tax on savings. No alternative minimum tax. Only Washington would call it minimum, so it's actually the mandatory maximum tax. George Orwell would have loved that one. No more death tax, allowed to leave the world unmolested by the IRS, or as our founders would say, no taxation without respiration. On the business side, cut the corporate tax rate. We now have the highest in the world next to that of Japan. Cut it from 35 down to 17, 35% to 17%, and get rid of depreciation schedules. Make an investment, you write it off in year one. If you have a loss, you carry it forward forever against future profits, so you use it up. Imagine the investment boom that would take place in this country. Imagine the flow of capital coming to this country. It'd be extraordinary. It'd be a mammoth version of Ireland. And the world would follow our example, because we're so big. So the world would prosper, and we could worry about something else. You know. So, long story short, there's a lot of positive things that can be done on the tax side, on Social Security, health care. Trade, though, there's a lot of dangers out there, which is why I think we're in this funk mood right now. The administration blew it on Social Security, blown it on taxes, on spending. But trade, very ominous, if that goes off the tracks. And the Federal Reserve, they continue to muck up. There are going to be short-term consequences to that. So there's plenty of reason to worry. But I think one of the good things about a free society is that, like the marketplace, if things go wrong, we eventually figure out why it went wrong. And eventually, as we saw in the early 80s, we get it right again. And we have a new surge forward. So I think this oil bubble will pop in the next 12 months. Oil go to $35, $40 a barrel. After all, China absorbs only 2 billion barrels a year out of 30 billion globally that we absorb of oil. Getting a billion barrels every 18 months coming online. And most of China's oil, a big chunk of it's wasted on generators. Peter Huber, energy expert, points out the Chinese are still trying to bring online traditional power plants, but until they do, they use these generators that absorb a lot of oil wastefully. So China's oil bill will grow. Their absorption of oil will grow, but in terms of the global economy, we're talking about 6%. Not that big a factor. If oil just goes to $35 a barrel, tar sands, shale suddenly become commercially viable. There's no shortage of this stuff. Eventually the bubble will burst. So, right now, plenty to worry about. That's precisely the opportunity to move forward, because the environment will change. Ready for it, you're going to have many more conferences like this, even bigger desserts than you did last night. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, Steve has agreed to answer questions from the audience, and we already have a question from the audience. Hey, why don't you get the, wait for the microphone. Okay, we're transcribing all that, so if we get the names and...
Peter Treadway, you didn't say anything about India. Will India be another Brazil, another country of the future that always will be, or will it... will the Indian recent improvements, will they continue on a secular basis? And also politically, can India be a reliable offset in Asia to China?
The answer is I'm optimistic about India. One is English, for obvious reasons, is a ubiquitous language there. They also have the English tradition of the rule of law, even though their court system today is dysfunctional. I mean, if you file a suit, your grandchildren may see the resolution of that suit. But they will eventually reform, I think, their judicial system. But they have a sense of rule of law, a sense of procedure that many countries don't have. Obviously, they have a very entrepreneurial class that's rising up. And I take comfort, even though their reforms have been jagged. I was hoping they'd do most of these anti-socialist reforms in the mid-1980s. But it's been at a slow pace. But the fact that they had an election change, I think it was about a year and a half ago, and the new government did not retreat, did not pull back on the liberalization reforms they'd made, I think it's very encouraging that they will go forward. So in that sense, I think India, in some ways, is even a surer bet than China. China has to develop these institutions. They may well do so, but I don't think they have the institutional base that the Indians have to build and have institutions there that will prevent them from going the way of Peru or Brazil or Argentina. Eventually, Brazil will get its act together. It just has been a long time in the making, but I'm optimistic on India. I think they'll avoid those traps, especially on property rights.
One over here.
Okay.
So I'll just jump in before him. Great talk on the productivity piece. Can you talk about your views of specifically the Internet? The web is now 10 years old this year and pretty much impacting a new generation and getting better. How is that impacting productivity? You mentioned kiosks and particularly global economy in terms of productivity.
Well, in terms of the net and productivity, obviously it's just absolutely wide open. And the only reason that hasn't even been more massive in this country is because we have not made the changes in truly opening up broadband the way the South Koreans and a growing number of other countries have. There's still a snail's pace relatively here. I've often said if we took the appropriate committees in Congress and the Federal Communications Commission and gave them a five-year one-way ticket to Pyongyang, it would probably be a very good thing. Then technology could move forward. But you see it in telephony, voice over internet protocol, now the rage. The net is obviously, and you know it better than anyone else, obliterated the traditional artificial differences between long distance and local telephony, TV, radio, satellite, cable. But you still have these crazy battles in Washington. Telephone companies were the cable companies are very smart in realizing they could go in the telephone business because they have the wire into your home. Now the telephone companies, as they put in the fiber, want to go in the video business. But the cablers are saying, no, you cannot do that. You have to get permission from every community in the country, i.e. get political permission for a franchise before your video services can be used. That's just such nonsense, retroactive, dinosaur kind of approach. I've always said what we should do, since no human being can figure out where this thing is going to go, is simply do a date certain. Pick 12 months from now, 18 months from now, all the traditional differences, go by the boards. You can do anything you want, anywhere you want, wide open, plenty of time to prepare for it. Get rid of, lobbyists will hate it, but maybe we can have job retraining. Maybe they can come here and, give you tour guides on the slopes or something. But it's ridiculous. So in terms of productivity, the cliche, you ain't seen nothing yet with the web, is absolutely true.
One more, and then we'll start the panel. We'll get everybody involved. But
Wayne Thomas. Steve, I wonder if we have let too much of our cat out of the bag in terms of being so free with our intellectual secrets and ideas with all these outsourcing and trade deals, and that if we may regret that in terms of our competitive advantages going forward.
In terms of intellectual property and trade secrets, I think you have to make the distinction between overt stealing of your intellectual property. If they steal my book, I'd be happy. But seriously, in terms of making something, a drug or something, and then finding knockoffs out, that is wrong, and we're right to put pressure on countries where that is winked and nodded at. But in terms of thinking that we can hoard our intellectual property and no one will figure out that we have it, as the British tried to do in the 18th century, and that we have established elaborate systems here to get this stuff anyway, it's going to seep through. And I think the way you stay ahead is not trying to hoard information, but actually realizing it's going to be out there, but figuring out where the value added is. That's where an open market figures out faster than your competitors do on how to get the value added from it. My favorite example, and our old editor Jim Michaels, you cited it frequently, is ask yourself, who made the most money from mainframe computers? It wasn't IBM's competitors. Even IBM nearly went under 15 years ago. The company that probably made the most money from mainframes was Walmart. Sam Walton, 40 years ago, recognized information was key, control of inventories was key. He used mainframes and software in a way that no other retailer did. The rest, as they say, is history. So the information was out there. The intellectual property was available for a fee, but he used it better than anyone else, and that's the key. Is that it's not like a secret weapon in a war where eventually you use it, you have a temporary advantage, and then everyone else catches up. You got to be one step ahead and have an environment where you can stay one step ahead. So I don't think if you have a great new breakthrough, I think the key is protecting it. That's legitimate. But the idea that you can prevent anyone else from eventually learning about it, our experience with the British 200 years ago shows that nature always finds a way around those things. So stay competitive.
Russell Redenbaugh, who's an investor, analyst, civil rights commissioner, and world jiu-jitsu champion. How many years, Russell? 3 years, world jiu-jitsu champion. Here he is. And he's joining us. And Rich Colgard, who we all know, and Brett Swanson.
Okay. Technology
group and expert on China.
We all on? Okay, let me ask the first question of the panelists on the subject of China, since we're going to be talking about China and India in lieu of John Rutledge's talk. Love to hear everybody on the panelists' opinion on this. That clearly the most fruitful economic relationship in the world right now is that between China and the United States. But both on their side and on our side, there are clouds on the horizon. There seem to be more China hawks in Washington than there were a year ago. Brett, you and George are going to be visiting Vice President Cheney next week and get a read on that. And then in China, Hu Jintao seems to be consolidating power and rolling back liberalization on media. Let's talk about Hu Jintao. Is he moving the capitalistic revolution forward in China, or are we at a pause?
I think that's a question that's still out. We always talk about the Chinese being something of an enigma, and we never quite figure out what exactly is going on, maybe until a few years down the road. For a long time, people saw Jiang Zemin as a potential menace, and he turned out to be, I think, in most respects, an expander of freedom and an extender of the leadership of Deng Xiaoping, which over the last 25 years, for all the hiccups, has just been an amazing positive story. I don't think we quite know about Hu yet, although he does not come from the Zhang sort of family tree from Shanghai, and he comes from the western part of the country, and one of his major efforts is to try to sort of, I don't know if equalize is the right word, western growth with what has happened along the coast. Now, if he employs the same strategies that they employed on the coast, that would be a tremendously positive thing. If it's some sort of, redistributionist effort, that would be less positive.
So too early to tell. Russell, what do you make of the political drumbeats in China?
Well, I actually know so little about that, although we did visit Asia three times this year. I'd like to comment more on the business and economic aspects. So if you want to go more on the political, why don't you come back to me after?
No, go on this business and economic theme.
Well, first, let me say, I'm sure that John Rutledge would rather be here than in Washington. He is meeting with the Secretary of Commerce to try and advance our cause of telecom deregulation. So he's certainly in a worthy mission. He said here in this room a year ago that countries don't compete for trade, and they don't compete for jobs. They compete for capital. And
he meant human capital as well.
Human capital as well. And if we look through the lens of countries competing for capital, the countries that are doing a good and increasingly good job are the U.S., China, and China's future rival, India. Now, we haven't yet been to India, so these are matters of first impression. But as Steve was saying so accurately, India is returning to a tradition of English common law, courts, property rights, contracts, fairness, which they strayed when they mistakenly took economic advice during the last 50 years from the Soviets. But now they're free to take it from the supply siders, and they are. So I think the really big question about China and India isn't so much about who or what, or who, but is what. And that is, what will the policies be? Will they be more supply side, or will they be more
on that
distribution?
On that point, Russell, and maybe this does go to who, not Hu Jintao, but one thing that I think is a big positive for China is the fact that a lot of us think that Robert Mundell, the 1999 Nobel Economics Prize winner, is in Beijing quite a bit now, mm-hmm. advising them on monetary and fiscal policy, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of us think that he has helped finesse this very troubling issue with the U.S. pushing them to revalue and the Schumer-Graham trade tariff bill, and he has helped finesse this away and at least push back a tariff bill in Congress. Now,
I would feel even more that it'll come back.
Yeah. But that does give me a little bit of comfort.
I would feel even better than I do if he would also go to Washington.
I agree.
I think that the way we look at China is really misconceived. I mean, this was the worst country in the world 20 years ago. I mean, it was a monster. It was a holocaust. It was an egregious example of the depravity to which humans can sink. And now it's the fastest growing creator of freedom and wealth in the whole world. This is a miracle. It's wonderful. We should celebrate it. Sure, they're more capitalist than we are in many respects. They actually enshrined in their constitution a couple years ago the sanctity of private property. The Supreme Court would throw that out in a minute in the United States. The tie to the dollar created a U.S.-China dollar zone that produced the tremendous growth in both countries over the last several years. The reason American entrepreneurs run a trade gap is because our growth is mostly internal and in China. So we're American exports are the only exporters in the world who can't export to the fastest growing economy, which is the United States, large economy. If we can't manage this relationship, if we sink back into some paranoid, militaristic sort of posture toward China, I think it's tragic. We do have to be militarily strong. That's not the Chinese fault if we if all our students want to study art history and I don't know what the and
law.
And law. That's our fault. China is, we're the ones who won't build nuclear plants. The Chinese are building 60 nuclear plants. They're addressing the energy crisis. We're fantasizing solar cells and imagining that we don't have to drill anymore or build any refineries or plants if we just disperse nanodust across the country. I think the Chinese are the hope of the world.
George, I hope you don't leave your best effort in the locker room. I hope you can bottle that and tell it to Vice President Cheney next week. Do you intend to?
Yeah. You know, on this point, George, you talk about our trade gap, and rarely, if ever, will you hear a more clear-headed explanation of trade and currencies than Mr. Forbes gave a couple minutes ago, mm-hmm. So I hope they'll take that to heart. But in fact, the latest numbers that I've seen show that China, in fact, will have its own trade deficit with the rest of the world because it's growing so fast. So in fact, that's for this year. So in fact, China is importing so much capital and growing so fast that except for the U.S. and maybe a few other countries, it in fact has its own trade gap, which I think is a positive sign.
By the way, on nuclear power plants, somebody told me this factoid the other day, those who take the Kyoto proposal seriously, if in 1979, before Three Mile Island, if we had gone ahead with every nuclear power plant that was then on the drawing board, brought them online, we'd meet the Kyoto protocols today. Steve, does the Smoot Schumer and Holly Graham faction in Washington gaining traction? And how do we stop it?
Well, it's like one of these bad things that keep popping up from time to time. It's an advance right now simply because they're focused on other things. But when China comes in the news again, as it will in the next 12 months, then you're going to see the cry again. They haven't done enough. They haven't followed through on the promise of trashing their currency even more. We got to hit them over the head. They're not playing fair. This, that, and the other thing. They'll cite that idiot general who said he wanted to nuke Los Angeles. And off we go to the races. So the challenge is the administration's got to get trade back on track again. And longer term, I don't know why, we've got this notion fixed in our minds that a trade gap is the equivalent of a company losing money. They're two totally, utterly separate things. And just keep in mind, when you buy something, you're engaging in a trade deficit. When you buy a shirt or go to a restaurant, that's a trade deficit, but that's also trade. And everyone supposedly comes out and ahead in a transaction. That's the essence of democratic capital.
Well, maybe they'll just hit Hollywood and Santa Monica, which I wouldn't feel so bad about. Russell, let's talk about India. A lot of talk about China, but you have some thoughts about India, and India as a real sort of ally to the United States, and there's a check and balance against militarism in China.
And in that whole region. And India, you know, since the end of the Cold War, is now free to play a completely different role and is doing so. Now, we should go there soon and study it, and then we'll know much more. But the thing that's remarkable about India is that it is very much like China. It has a lot of poor people. And poor people need one thing. They need money. And they know how to get it in India and China. They get it through working. So there is this entrepreneurial spirit in these places. In Italian, I call it the business of the poor. There is a huge, huge market in selling things in India to poor people. They have to be designed differently, but there's this entrepreneurial spirit there. And, we'll know more when we're back, but I think there's a great opportunity for the country and for people who invest in India. So it's one of the things that we're considering.
I'd like to open it up from questions for the audience. Yes, we have one. We have several, but we'll start way back here.
Wait for the...
Tony, I can talk. Harvard Research Institute. Some years from Pacific Research Institute. There seems to be a discrepancy between, you know, Steve Forbes said that because of institutions, you place your bets with India over China. And then George Gilder just said, you know, China is the hope of the world. And it seems to me that while there's a lot of economic freedom in China, the political freedoms are still really far behind. We just saw Yahoo give a whole bunch of information about one of their subscribers to the Chinese government, who then threw journalists in jail for 10 years. And so I'm curious what you have to say about political freedoms going ahead.
Well, and maybe the reconciliation, how far can China's reforms go without an equal path toward democratization?
I'll take a shot. I mean, it's clearly an important issue, and we shouldn't stop talking about these human rights issues and press freedom, although other journalists in other nations have been put in jail recently also. And the internet issue is clearly a big one. For now, it looks like they're having some success in blocking certain sites and things. I don't know that can continue forever. But I think another misconception we have is that China is a highly centralized autocratic government. In some senses, it's centralized, but economically, it is extremely decentralized. And increasingly, it's politically decentralized. It's going to take time. It's going to, this Chinese story is going to unfold over a number of decades. I think that although there are still political problems, they're far more politically free than, as George said, they were several decades ago, and I think they'll be more politically free decades from now.
And I think people in the United States tend to underestimate economic freedom. We have it, so we don't understand its significance. But economic freedom is political freedom. The fact that there's a huge middle class, a huge agglomeration of new sources of economic power rising up all over China is a fundamental advance in itself for political freedom. It changes the whole structure of power in the country. And I believe that there's more political power and freedom has been distributed in China than anywhere else in the history of the world over the last couple decades.
One of the principal problem that we have with China, and when I say we put it in quotes, I mean the policy establishment of the country, is around this issue around trade. And that's only a problem because they don't understand, but it's a problem because people think that's connected to jobs. So if there weren't a jobs threat from China, then a lot of these China problems really wouldn't be problems. The U.S. is headed toward a labor shortage. Natalia has a very good article on it called The Perfect Storm. We're going to run out of lots of workers starting fairly soon.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And as that happens, of course, there'll be more and more outsourcing to places that can do that. But the political pressure against China and forcing China to make monetary policy mistakes, I think will diminish a lot.
So many hands up. Let's go Richard Vigilani, then we'll go to Ashby. And how much time do you want to go, George? We're a little bit over. 10 minutes?
We aren't over the panel, are we?
I think we are. Yeah. Okay, we'll take two more questions,
okay.
Starting with you, Richard.
Yeah, I think just as comparing the expected change in China and India, China is breaking out of communism. India is rising up from liberalism, right? And I think Russell slightly misspoke. Indian economic policy wasn't made in Moscow. It was made in Harvard. So obviously you're going to expect more explosive growth in China. India may be a more comfortable place for American investors for the same set of reasons. But in terms of political repression and economic repression, it is much easier to murder people than it is to regulate them, right? And the Chinese were very successful at murdering people. But there is no evidence at all that the Chinese are able to regulate their economy. They can't keep data on their version of Social Security. They have their economic statistics are always wrong, not because they're lying. That was the old model when bureaucrats lied. Now the companies lie, and the Chinese show no ability to effectively regulate their economy. So that, you know, they have a political infrastructure which could do murder, but it can't do regulation. And in that sense, Chinese economic freedom is not likely to be turned back.
I think Mr. Forbes' comments about India, about all the advantages they have, are quite correct. They do have a number of big advantages. But India also has a far more intrusive as you might say, effective bureaucracy than mm-hmm. China. China does not have any sort of a bureaucracy that does anything that, well from the bureaucrat's perspective.
Good point. Ashby, we'll give you the final question.
One of the few macro forces that Steve didn't cover in his discussion was that of demographics. Russell just touched on it a little bit, but even the UN now is admitting that the world population growth is slowing and slowing faster than expected, and many of the developed economies are going to face in the decades ahead dramatically lower populations because of the declining population rate. Do you have any comments on what that means?
Russell, do you want to take that? Because China's got a real demographic bomb in the making.
And Japan's went off already. Let me do it quickly. China is beginning to have a demographic problem in that they have more 25-year-old men than 25-year-old women by a wide margin. Think back. This would be a great problem. They are still growing rapidly. There is this quiet confidence and optimism in China. We also visited Japan. We did the Japan demographic study 2 or 3 years ago called The Death of Birth. They basically stopped having children about 25 years ago in Japan. You can't recover from that. And if you start to, it gets worse before it gets better, because, gosh, it still takes 18 years to make a worker. So the outlook for Japan is very bleak. The outlook for China, I'd say it's a cloud, but there will and can be solutions. So it's absolutely an indicator to watch. But Japan has tipped over the cliff, and there's no recovery.
Any final thoughts?
Well, among the dumb things we're doing now is making it harder for legal immigrants to come into this country. I don't have to tell you about the problem with H-1B. If you were the INS, you try to come in here legally. Nightmare. And one of the things that surprised me after 2001, after 9/11, is that we don't have the software infrastructure so that we can know whether you should be in this country or not in this country. And I know when I go to Australia, they openly say they're recruiting students by, in effect, saying if you get in here, you won't be hassle-free in and out. Whereas with the United States, if you go home for a vacation, you don't know what you're going to face when you try to get back here to resume your studies. So we've got to realize, again, people are capital. People are a resource, not just mouths to feed. They figure out how to feed the mouths and much else. And that's another area where we're dropping the ball in addition to the ones that I discussed earlier. The people, we're like a baseball team. Our farm team isn't bringing up enough players, but we're also not doing enough as we used to do to get players from other teams, as we do in high tech, by allowing people to come in and study. George made a very good suggestion a year ago when he said if you get a degree here, an advanced degree, a green card should be embedded in your diploma. It's a very good thing.
Well, with that, let's thank our panel, and I think we can now move to a break.
Take a short 15-minute coffee break and resume the conference at 9:45. Thank you.